Welcome everyone to Filmstrips, the podcast about evil, pure and simple, by way of the eighth dimension. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I think I'm Andrew Kanagiezer. Hard to tell ever since I went halfway through that wall.
Yeah, but yes, welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every episode we take a look at a film, discuss it. The only trick is each and every film under discussion must connect back to the film we were taking a look at in the preceding episode. And Andrew, last time was your pick, and what was the film we were taking a look at on this little program of ours?
Well, last week, you and I looked at a film that we were both pretty big fans of, and with some time, I think has become easier and easier to like. That would be Wes Anderson's 2005 The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, featuring a performance from the one, the only, the inimitable Jeff Goldblum, who we've decided to follow this week to a film that I know Dave has referenced probably more than any other property aside from Doctor Who in the time that I have known him, and one where the title alone has always made me roll my eyes. Dave, what are we looking at this week?
Today we're taking a look at the 1984 film from director W.D. Richter and writer Earl MacRonch. That is the one, the only, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. Yes, the sci-fi fantasy classic that is near and dear to my heart. And the big question being, will it be near and dear to Andrew's heart? Stay tuned. But before we get there, Andrew, I believe there was something that you wanted to speak, you know, deeply and heartfeltly to towards our listeners at this point in time.
Okay. Well, I mean, by the time this episode comes out, it's going to be old news, so we sound really out of touch. But in the interest of paying our respects, especially to the travelers that we've encountered on our merry film strip, we were very saddened to hear about the passing of one Rip Torn, who, you know, he is one of the great that guys. Everybody has seen him be amazing in at least one film. The stories of his life seem so much more interesting than many of the movies he was in. But finally, time came for him to leave the stage. And that also made me thinking in the back of my mind, there was Dick Richards, who we talked about on our show. There was Rip Torn, who we've talked about at many different junctures, and indeed was the point of connection across a number of films. I'm really fearful to check the news every time we open, we release a new episode, David. But that being said, Rip Torn, he had a very long career spanning all types of different American cinematic projects. And honestly, I mean, whether you see him as, the silent Barry Mills in, A Face in the Crowd, whether you see him as the CEO, the most delightfully cartoony villain that doesn't use cell shading in RoboCop 3, there's some good Rip Torn out there for you.
Yeah, absolutely, and let us all live by the immortal words he left us with. If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
And clearly Norman Mailer can't dodge a ball, but that's another film for another day. But yeah, so Buckaroo Banzai, which I only recently found out has nothing to do with Yahoo Serious.
Oh god, don't even bring up that name in remote connection to this thing, because one of these things is a work of genius and the other thing's Yahoo Serious. But I can't tell
which is which.
Oh boy. Anyways, yes, so The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. Now, you have probably, at the very least, heard this title over the years, and certainly it's one of those titles that probably sticks in your head, but you may not actually be able to tell and say, is that a real movie? Well, don't worry. We are here to assure you that yes, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension is indeed a real movie that exists that you can go ahead and rent. And I will say this, Andrew, I discovered this film back when I was a teenager, and I will at least let you know just how dedicated I was to tracking it down.
Okay.
I live in a small town, folks. And at that point in time, you know, there were still things such as rental shops here. There were actually three once upon a time, and I certainly went out of my way once I heard about this movie and understood it to be a cult sci-fi comedy that, yes, I needed to track it down. But not a single video shop around where I lived had it. I actually had to go to another city nearby, 15-20 minute drive out of town, And by me, I mean beg my father to help me set up an account at a rental shop in a nearby city that had the only copy that it was around for miles of this movie, so I could rent it and watch it.
Now, so, Dave, yes. I would say I'm saying this as an adult in 2019, but after a point, I mean, like, we've been looking at some fairly odd, some fairly obscure, and certainly some very cult films in recent episodes. I'm just wondering, after a point, when does the obscurity of something kind of hint as to its quality, I guess? More so, like, we live in a time where it's like the harder something is to find, there's almost that perceived sense that the more transgressive or valuable or just too out there the work is. After a point, it's like, well, maybe there just weren't a lot of copies because stores never bothered to stock it.
Well, okay, here's the thing. I will say this, that certainly in the case, sometimes, yes, the obscurity of something might be an indicator of quality. We're looking at you, the last movie. But the thing about it is that in the case of Buckaroo Banzai, I think, number one, let's be clear. I live in a small town in Canada, in Ontario, folks. You know, and when I say small town, I do mean small town. So it's not like I had access to, you know, video stores with the highest depth of background copies of anything. So I'm not really sure that this local area should be used as a judgment upon things, because yeah. I can assure you, Fellini's 8.5 would not have been around here either. Trust me. So
yeah, I mean, I grew up in a small town too. And I mean, like, we didn't have Criterion films or anything that would have premiered at the Venice Film Festival, but they did have copies of Movie Maker magazine, so I could at least know of them. I grew up in a town so small, the police precinct had a screen door.
Yes, yes. But the key thing here is that in the case of Buckaroo Banzai, certainly for a good while, it was relatively obscure when I was growing up in the 90s. But it was something that very quickly gained a cult following starting in the 80s. Now, to make this clear, to back up and give a little bit of production context, because we don't want to be too mired in this necessarily.
That being said, though, David, the reason I ask, and I mean, frequent listeners of our show know that we don't always talk about our personal journey of coming to a film, but I think in the case of Buckaroo Banzai, that may be very apt, simply because you and I, we haven't discussed much about this film, but I gather we're probably going to see it through different lenses. And I feel like a work, especially with the tone and the sensibility that the film under discussion this week has, I feel like that really, that your tolerance for that kind of tone, I think that is informed by when you encounter this film in your life and sort of what your sensibilities as a viewer are. But yes, so what is Buckaroo Banzai in the first place?
Okay, so let's lead us back to the late 1970s and introduce you to two people in particular. That being the eventual director of this film, W.D. Richter, who started off as a screenwriter, writing a number of notable films such as Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1978, that little film that we've covered previously on the show, and we love the heck out of.
Likewise, movie.
Yeah. He also wrote the John Badham version of Dracula, and eventually would go on to write the screenplay for the Stephen King adaptation, Needful Things. We'll get there probably one day, folks. Because
funny enough, it's not a true film strip connection, but for a while as a kid, we lived in a small town in British Columbia, and that happened to coincide with them filming Needful Things in and around the area. I
really?
Have a distinct fuzzy memory of all of us gathered in like the middle of the town to watch them film the scene where they lit the church on fire. And I remember being too young to even notice of like, oh, hey, Ed Harris is there digging a cigarette butt out of the gutter or whatever. You know, I'm just like, wow, there's a whole lot of people standing around waiting for something to happen.
But were you old enough to notice Charlton Heston signing, you know, more materials for the NRA going forward?
I did not, but I was old enough to recognize, wow, this movie seems pretty boring and stupid.
And we'll get there one day once again, folks. But yes, the other individual was writer Earl MacRonch. Now, you may be less familiar with him, but he actually was somebody who wrote or co-wrote Martin Scorsese's New York, New York, a kind of underrated little musical that he did starring Robert De Niro and Liza Minnelli, if I'm remembering correctly. He would also go on to write the much less well-received and extremely controversial Wired, the sort of biopic of John Belushi that, from all accounts, Dan Aykroyd vowed to destroy the careers of anybody and everybody who happened to have been involved with it. But,
well, as they say, the more you try and destroy the careers of everyone involved in Wired, the more you destroy your own. I will fully admit, David, interest of full disclosure, remember, I'm the bad film nerd. I don't know what either of those movies are.
Okay, one of these days we're going to get to New York, New York. You don't have to worry about Wired. We'll probably never get there. Point being, the reason I bring this up is that both of these individuals were coming from fairly high-profile careers, coming into. I mean, certainly, if you're working with Scorsese, Badham in the 1970s, and Philip Kaufman, you know, you have to carry some clout with you. And starting in the early 1980s, there were Mack Ronk wrote the screenplay for Buckaroo Banzai, which was at one point in development at Fox, before sort of falling apart. Eventually, this thing would actually come together through an independent producer who, needless to say, did not see eye to eye with any of the people making this movie and went out of their way to make the production as miserable as possible, even arguing with things like, for example, that its star should not wear glasses at any point in time because action heroes don't wear glasses. This went to the point where he actually ended up hiring somebody to be on set to report to him if they ever violated his rules. Turns out that individual quickly caught on to the kind of movie they were making and refused to sort of pass along the messages he was hired to do. So it gives you a bit of an indicator.
Now, was that before or after the studio insisted that Jordan Cronenweth got fired as well?
Probably along the same time, because yes, this film did have the cinematographer for Blade Runner, who was eventually fired and replaced with Fred J. Kopenkamp, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly, the cinematographer of The Towering Inferno. And we'll get into the visual look of this movie in a bit, because it'll be interesting to see whether we notice any major shifts or not throughout it. But the key thing being here that it was something of a troubled production, and ultimately by the time it was released, it pretty much came out with little to no actual marketing push behind it, and quickly disappeared from theaters. However, in the year, once it was released on video, the film started developing a fairly quick cult, or a big cult following around that time. Even with individuals such as Quentin Tarantino noting that if they probably made a sequel a few years later, it probably would have been a much bigger success than the first film was because more people were aware of it. I'm not sure whether we want to agree with Tarantino on that or not. Certainly his love of obscure genre fiction can sometimes cloud his judgment, but...
Yeah, I was gonna say, I wonder if he's saying that because Quentin Tarantino strikes me as the exact kind of male film fan that this movie is precision engineered for.
And you wouldn't be wrong about that, but yes, the key point of the matter is, to come back to it, is that yes, Buckaroo Banzai is something that has actually lingered quite a bit in the pop cultural memory, at least as far for its dedicated cult fan base. And yeah, it remains kind of a big title in terms of home video. MGM ended up releasing a special edition version of this thing on DVD, which is where I ended up getting to see it the second time, which was enough of a huge success. Shout Factory ended up releasing it on Blu-ray as the starting point for their signature collection of titles, and then re-release the thing in a steel case edition a few years later, which is the one I watched this from. Yes, thank you, good folks at Show Factory. But the point of the matter here is that it is a film that has survived, and yes, as you were noting, Andrew, it is something that there has always been discussion about doing something else with, starting with Richter and Ron trying to get a television series started in the early 2000s, and eventually the threatened Kevin Smith production for Amazon, which ended due to lawsuits a few years ago. So Banzai's always been sort of at the cusp of a resurrection of some point. Whether that's a good thing or not, well, we'll get into here or in a momentarily. But the big question, then, to return to your point, Andrew, is what on earth is Buckaroo Banzai? And as the individual...
Well, and that's
who...
the question that has always astounded me, because I've heard all of this discourse about Buckaroo Banzai, and you're right, I intersect with a lot of circles that hold this film very near and dear. I have certainly seen many appraisals and fan sites. I mean, there's even a fake Yoyodyne website that is basically a big tribute site to this film. It is a title that you do not forget hearing once you have heard it. And right up until the moment I press play, I had no idea what this film actually was.
Yes, so to get into this, number one, we should warn folks at this point, spoilers ahead. We will spoil the hell out of this movie, as we typically do, because, and for this film in particular, I mean, if we're going to describe the plot in any way, shape, or form, it's going to require spoilers as we go. But effectively, what Buckaroo Banzai is a sci-fi comedy that is, in many ways, it's wrong to call it a lampooning of classic serialized fiction, genre fiction tropes, but it certainly is a playful satire, poking fun at them while embracing them for all they're worth. And in particular, the sort of mass world-building minutiae that can really tends to turn mainstream people away, or mainstream audiences away, or casual viewers away, I should say, from either reading things like, for example, is a great a comparison point, the X-Men comics. If you have ever tried to dive into these things at any point, you may find yourself completely bewildered and confused as to what you're getting yourself into while reading them, because over time, particularly started after Chris Claremont started writing the book in 1975, so much ongoing continuity and subplots and material and a wider range of characters have been part of this book where at times it can be borderline impenetrable for anybody getting into
Because
it.
anyone who's ever been like, hey, is Gambit still in the X-Men? It's like, well, technically not, because he's out of the main series, and then he was in New Mutants, but then he was in the new X-Men, but only in the second timeline that became the Age of Apocalypse. And it's like, when you need to give somebody an encyclopedia and like a Cliff Notes before they can even start reading it, I think you've kind of done something wrong. But again, David, we are talking about everything about Buckaroo Banzai, but what, who is Buckaroo Banzai? Let's
Okay.
start there.
All right. So effectively, the central premise of Buckaroo Banzai is not dissimilar from classic pulp characters like Doc Savage. Basically, Buckaroo Banzai is an adventurer. He is a scientist. He is a neurosurgeon. He is a rock musician. And he is somebody who has traveled the world and gathered together a close group of friends and associates called the Hong Kong Cavaliers, who not only rock out with him, but also join him in his many crazy adventures. He has become so famous across at least America, if not worldwide, that basically he has an entire dedicated fan base across the country, with people signing up to be part of the Buckaroo Banzai, what's more or less a sort of fan club slash extended paramilitary organization, as it were, where you get to become a Blue Blazer regular, which is, I'm not gonna lie, is still one of my favorite names for anything out there. That makes me so happy for reasons that I cannot even explain.
I'm more of a Zsu Society man myself, but well, I mean, but at the same time, like, sorry to cut you off. Don't worry, folks. We will explain what the plot of this movie is. But going back to our discussion last week about The Life Aquatic, you know, I don't know how much of the final discussion ended up involving this, but you had brought up that it's difficult to think of a movie like The Life Aquatic without using The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension as a point of comparison. Because now that I have seen this film, I want to talk about The Life Aquatic again, and I think I can give a better explanation of what it is in that film that's appealing to me. Because you're right, this is a film that very much feels like The Life Aquatic in reverse, where all of the failings that we see in Steve Zissou are not issues, because Buckaroo is just, he's awesome, he's cool, he's nice. There's nothing wrong with this cat. Everyone wants to be him, and who wouldn't? And I mean, you are also right. The closing credits of this film cannot be anything other than the inspiration for the Life Aquatic's closing credits. We'll get there. It's better to start at the beginning and not at the end, though.
Yes.
But yeah, so the film very briefly establishes all of these traits of Buckaroo Banzai, and we're basically introduced to him as he leaves a complicated surgery where he can try out a new invention of his. And what is that invention, David?
This is the overthruster, which is part of a car which can apparently, in as far as the military is concerned, as represented by the Secretary of Defense played by the returning Matt Clark to the show, who in this instance, he thinks it's just a car that's going to go incredibly fast that can break the sound barrier. In truth, it's actually testing a invention that goes back back to 1938, which was in development by Dr. Professor Hakita and Dr. Emilio Lizardo, which involves the idea of breaking through to the eighth dimension, effectively traveling into the spaces in between molecules, it seems. And
yeah, because they briefly summarize, it's not quite to the degree of Looper, where they literally just hand wave away. As we don't have time to get into how this works. But, I mean, Banzai, who I think maybe 20 minutes into the episode, it should be operative to point out, is played by Peter Weller, returning to the show as well.
Yes.
This film is like that missing piece for so many different connections. But as Banzai explains, you know, scientists over the last century discovered that matter is not actually all that dense. That instead there's the cloud of electrons that hang around the nucleus. So really, what we see as solid matter is largely empty space. And presumably what the overthruster is trying to do is find a way to travel through that empty space and move through objects and realize like the dimensions that are inside of them. Now, that may also sound similar to the cat's necklace in Men in Black, which also featured Rip Torn.
Yes.
But that's another film for another day. The problem is that, yes, it turns out the overthruster works, and Buckaroo ends up driving through a mountain. Well, rather, seems like he drives through a mountain. In truth, he actually crosses the eighth dimension and picks up a small specimen of brain matter along the way. However, this triggers the first complicating event, and believe you me, there are many complicating events, where the imprisoned Dr. Lizardi, played by John Lithgow in full hamming it up mode, also John Lithgow returning to the show.
Yep.
He ends up seeing the successful test on television, and basically irked by his failure to succeed back in the 1930s, you know, getting stuck midway through dimensions and going insane as a result, he breaks out of the mental institution and declares all-out war on Buckaroo Banzai.
Well,
and then
he disappears
from the film for about 45 minutes.
Well, you see, but this is the thing. It's a little bit more complicated than that because, number one, we should know that the hospital guard is played by one Jonathan Banks, future star of, yes, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
Whoa, right!
Yeah.
For a second, oh man, up until now I was thinking of Jonathan Winters and I'm an idiot.
That's okay. But the key thing is that while Lizardo seems insane, that's not actually the case, because it turns out that when he was halfway stuck in the eighth dimension back in October of 1938, he became possessed by Lord John Worfen, a black lectroid, or red lectroid from the eighth dimension. Basically, think of it as the Phantom Zone, where a series of prisoners from Planet 10, who were basically the equivalent of the Nazis on their world, were shoved in there, imprisoned to be forgotten for all time. The problem is that during this whole experiment, a number of them escaped. Lizardo was possessed by Worfen, and since 1938, they've gone on to infest the world by creating Yoyodyne Propulsions, basically a cover operation for them trying to replicate the experiment so that they can make their way back home to Planet 10 to conquer it. Who else noticed, though, that Buckaroo Banzai has actually broken through the dimensional barrier? Why none other than the citizens of Planet 10, who are a little bit concerned because they don't want the Lord John Worfen and his crew to show back up on their planet. So basically, they've shown up in the effort to both warn/help Buckaroo, but the threat that if they have to, we will eradicate your planet if need be to make sure that they never show back up where we need to go.
Yeah, it's not a help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope. It's a Obi-Wan, if you don't help me, I'm going to cause a global nuclear war. So it's in your interest to help me, right? A little less snappy and quotable, but that's effectively their plan. So Buckaroo ends up finding himself as sort of the intermediary in a cosmic interdimensional civil war between two different groups of Lectroids, some of which have taken human form, some of which have not, all hinging in the brain of John Lithgow. Sounds pretty straightforward.
Sort of. What we haven't also noted is that somehow, yes, the War of the Worlds broadcast from 1938 that Orson Welles was involved with is, yes, somehow part of the plot line. There are certainly additional complications as the bedridden president with a bad back is uncertain that the basically whether this whole situation is going to lead to nuclear war between the United States and Russia. Oh, and in amongst this, what we end up having is Ellen Barkin as Penny Pretty, a woman who Buckaroo meets during a delightful music performance at Artie's Club, where, yes, as it turns out, after failing to commit suicide and everybody assuming that she was there to shoot and kill Buckaroo, she's actually quite possibly the twin doppelganger of Buckaroo's late wife, who was killed by the World Crime League. But we'll get there, folks. So there is a bucket load going on in this movie, and the best way to think about it is that effectively the joke of this movie, the big central joke of it, is that this is what everybody accuses the Marvel movies these days of being, of quote-unquote being so impenetrable if you haven't seen the first 23 of them in order to understand what's going on here. Well, Buckaroo Banzai basically is like the 23rd Marvel movie, and then it assumes that you've seen all the preceding 22. The problem is, there were no preceding 22 films, so you're basically, the expectation is, you have to try and piece everything together and keep up with the lunacy that is going on screen in terms of subplots, character relationship dynamics, the minutia of the universe, and it plays everything with a deadpan approach from start to finish, as embodied by Peter Weller's absolutely stoic, stone-faced performance as the title character in this film.
Well, I'm gonna halt you there, though, David, because
yes.
Just because something is deadpan doesn't mean that it's not being ironic. And
yes.
I mean, in previous episodes, we've also talked about how, especially as I get older, irony becomes like a self-limiting trap, almost. But it's just, what I can't reconcile is, like, the film certainly sets itself up in a very streamlined way. You get that very sort of retro, like, that very clear throwback to film serials with that opening title crawl that just introduces Buckaroo Banzai, man of letters, you know, the son of a Japanese and American scientist. Here are all the things that he could do. Bored of medicine, he decided to travel the world and adventure. Sets it up. It brings us all up to speed the way that film serials do. And then it proceeds to complicate everything needlessly. I guess my question is, though, it adds all these layers of complexity, but do the characters themselves or the world, does it ever actually get more complex as a result? I mean, in the same way that all the new information we learn about the characters, it doesn't really change the way we react to them as we do at the beginning of the film. I mean, finding out that Penny could be the long-lost twin sister of Buckaroo's deceased wife that we never meet and gets, like, two lines of exposition on and then disregarded. Like, does that add anything to the character? Does it add a wrinkle, or is it just another quirk to adorn your characters with?
Here's
and the reason I'm asking you this, it's not because I have a clear answer in my head. I mean, I think a lot of that is going to be very subjective to the viewer, but because you're talking about, like, the denseness of this world, and there's certainly a lot going on, but I walked away from this film feeling like it's a very cluttered world, but it's very superficial at the same time.
But the thing about it is I think, again, this is where I'm really emphasizing the notion of its pulp roots. Because when you go back and you read things like old Doc Savage novels or the Shadow pulps,
yes,
stories,
there's
there.
A very clear through line between those characters and Buckaroo Banzai Not only how he acts, but how the film itself mythologizes him.
Well, that's the thing, because the reality is, and I say this as somebody who loves reading those old Shadow stories, who loves reading those old Doc Savage things, they aren't character pieces. They are very much plot adventure-driven stories where it's all about getting to the next propulsive act. And Buckaroo Banzai is unabashedly in the exact same vein. This is not a film where you describe Buckaroo's amazing character arc where he evolves as a person. This is just the latest adventure in the string of Buckaroo Banzai. So, Buckaroo Banzai stories. So you can say that he is a static character in that way, in the way everybody's sort of a static character. But that's kind of the point in part of where the humor lies, is that it's not about seeing Buckaroo necessarily evolve that much or to any great degree. It's just a matter of, yeah, this is exactly like what you would get out of those old adventure tales, lovingly amped up to an absurd degree. So, and again, dropping you into the midst of it where, again, as an adult, realizing that there's no context for 90% of what's going on, while realizing that there probably is, a rational explanation for all the weirdness and all the attention to detail of the weirdness that's going on in this film, is where the humor lies. So looking at it from a character perspective, I think is, I mean, again, the character work that's going on is more in terms of the weird relationships and oddball details and quirky things that are going on with this. Like, for example, one Buckaroo is up, during the scene that introduces Penny, there is them playing there, and the
And
big
that may
gag of it.
actually be my favorite scene in the film.
And it's, well, it's probably, it's easily the most quoted scene of the film, because it involves Peter Weller delivering the iconic line, "Hey, hey, hey, don't be mean. We don't have to be mean, because remember, no matter where you go, there you are." Which is either the most insightful or the most meaningless statement known to man. And it
Well,
probably
maybe
is.
it's like talking heads once in a lifetime. Maybe it can be both.
And
And
that's a.
then he goes into a surprisingly emotive piano cover of "Since I Don't Have You."
Well, yes, and you've got weird little details where, again, they don't shoot the scene in order to emphasize the joke. It's all about paying attention to what's going on. When Buckaroo, the part of the gag is that, first of all, while playing all this loud rock music right at the front of the room, he can hear that somebody is crying there. Because again, Buckaroo is just that amazing in this
Yeah,
world.
it's not even that he can hear it, it's just he stops, he senses it.
Exactly. And what makes it better is somebody not having a good time. If you pay very close attention, you will see Pinky Carruthers' hand go up as part of the band, and nobody comments, nobody says anything, and you just get the sense, like, it's those weird little detail touches that amuse me every time I watch this film, because there's always another layer to the gag that's going on there, where it's like, it's not just that Buckaroo can sense that something's wrong. He's also clearly not paying attention to what's going on in his own band at the same time. And again, just like that kind of weird little minutia, or the fact that, yes, he has somehow managed to accrue a crew of people who are both scientists or experts in certain fields, who can all also happen to play instruments and can perform decently enough to make a half decent rock combo together, and that these people are willing to drop things. Like, again, I love Jeff Goldblum in this film, because he feels like in another type of film, for
Okay, let's walk
example.
it back, David. Who is Jeff Goldblum in this film?
Okay, Jeff Goldblum is introduced at the start of this movie as a scientist colleague of Buckaroo Banzai, who calls him in to help with a form of neurosurgery, which does lead to as he's explaining to Buckaroo this whole complicated thing about how he got lost as he was sort of looking through here. This eventually leads to Buckaroo giving a long, detailed explanation back, which leads to the immortal lines, "No, don't tug on that. You never know what it might be attached to." Again, I love the quotes in this movie, but the key thing is that, yes, he is the character of New Jersey. Now, let's be clear about this. In another type of film, like Guillermo del Toro's first Hellboy, New Jersey would be the audience surrogate character who comes in and is basically our introductory character to this weird, strange world, and making sure that we understand everything that's going on, and that's the person who's able to ask the questions and follow through. And again, I love the gag that while he's set up like that, immediately everything is subverted. Because first of all, he's called New Jersey. but he's invited to join Buckaroo's band of the Hong Kong Cavaliers, as provided the fact that he can actually play an instrument and sing, which he can. He's called, his nickname's New Jersey because he's from New Jersey, yet he wears a cowboy hat and over and jeans and spurs for reasons that are never explained. He seems to think he knows everything about Buckaroo's crew, but then quickly starts messing up their names, like not recognizing that Reno isn't Perfect Tommy, and vice versa, going through there. And yeah, from that point forward, he ceases to function as an audience surrogate character. He just gets wrapped up in the weirdness along with everybody else, and is there to deliver exposition about Orson Welles' radio broadcast on The War of the Worlds in 1938 later on in this film.
Well, yeah, like, this is the kind of film where its structure is frequently, like, Buckaroo is in a room with somebody having an intense discussion, and then it cuts away to the team that's huddled around computers and clacking their fingers, not showing the screen, and someone says, "Hey, guess what I just discovered?" And then they relay the message. Like, that's fine, but I guess this may seem like an aside, but I'm going to try to make this actually speak to the issue. Sure. I never watched Mystery Science Theater growing up. And after a point, I ended up realizing, like, certain sectors of the internet, you get bombarded with quotes. And, you know, people just throwing in, "He tried to kill me with a forklift," where, you know, it cracks certain people up. Yeah. But there's also very much a sense of insiderism and almost a sense of cliqueness, where it's like you either get it and it becomes the shared, like, almost a universal language, or like this badge that fellow enthusiasts can wear. And if you don't get it, it's like, well, nuts to you then. Like, you're too thick to get it. And I feel like that there might be a space where the film is sort of self-reflexively critiquing that, with everyone just being a jerk to New Jersey, despite insisting that he come along and join their gang without ever really indicating why that's necessary. But then he just gets wrapped up in it, and then everything proceeds as normal. I guess, like, it feels, this very much strikes me as a film, and maybe thinking of it in terms of a movie that wants to both be like a caricature and a loving rendition of a certain style of filmmaking and a certain style of narrativity, I feel like perhaps the way it comes off here, whether it's because ambitions were greater than what they could achieve, or maybe it's just ineptitude of people involved, I feel like it doesn't work. And instead, there are more junctures where it feels like a film that's trying to have it both ways, rather than a film that's drawing our attention to interesting contradictions. Does that make sense, or am I Buckaroo Banzai-ing myself right now?
It makes a degree sense, but I don't think the film is ever, I don't think, first, I would say the film doesn't make a point of being a jerk to New Jersey so much as, I mean, it's just, yeah, New Jersey's new to the crew, he's just sort of weirded out, but again, once the going gets going, he's just part and parcel of the scenes. And I think a lot of it, about this film is that I don't think that there was ever much like in the case of Neil Young and Dean Stockwell's Human Highway. I don't know how much a mainstream commercial consideration was really part of this. I think that they hoped that there would
be. But this is also a studio production made by people that were connected to Hollywood and some of the power players at the time. Like, this isn't being funded by Neil Young on a purpose-built backlot out of his own pocket and relying on a lot of favors from friends. Like, this is a film that, at least, I mean, Richter certainly had a certain presence in Hollywood at the time. I mean, the original cinematographer was, as we said, Jordan Cronenweth, who probably didn't come cheap. And I mean, we have a cast that includes Peter Weller, Ellen Barkin, John Lithgow, Clancy Brown, Jeff Goldblum, Christopher Lloyd, Matt Clark, Dan Hedaya, Vincent Schiavelli, Jonathan Banks. Like, it's got an enormous cast to the point where it's like, you can't put that together. Like, I guess if you're thinking, all right, we're going to make a project on this scale and this ambitious, and we're not going to worry if it makes money back, that's basically an attitude that's going to guarantee your film a
I'm not
failure.
saying that they didn't, weren't concerned about making their money back. What I am saying, though, is that, and again, and I give credit to them. I mean, there is a point where the idea of trying to assume that the audience isn't going to get it or isn't going to enjoy it is going to be self-defeating, because if that's the case, you're always going to be stuck doing the same thing. This is a group that's definitely pushing the envelope in terms of making a film that is both a satire, number one, of a very, admittedly a niche, but not necessary, but not an ignored part of popular culture. I mean, if you say Doc Savage in the Shadow, enough people are going to recognize what it is. And certainly by 1984, we're also talking about an audience that had, for a good chunk of the adults there, had grown up reading DC Comics, Marvel Comics, who were used to that form of storytelling going into it. So I could see them making the reasonable argument that, well, you know what? There's an audience out there that's probably going to get this and who knows enough coming into it that maybe this will work. Were they wrong? Yes. And I would say that if you were to play this film now, it would probably go over much better. At least more people would be aware of what it's trying to do at the very least at that point.
Or at least that space has opened up where this style of filmmaking, I think, is more readily accepted. Maybe because like the buying power of that sector of audience is bigger or something. Like this film is not dissimilar from something like, say, more recently, the Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency series, where it's trying to make smart things cool. I guess that's very much like the tone I got from this movie. And that's why thinking about it, like, I feel this is a film that's very much built for those nerdy, self-styled intellectual kids in high school that didn't fit in. And they're suddenly being given this image of, well, it turns out if you work hard and you apply yourself to the hard sciences, eventually people are going to recognize just how cool and important you are. And I mean, that's fine. Kids certainly need role models that they see some of themselves in. And hopefully without getting into really long polemics about the proper skin complexion of fictional mermaids. But the whole idea is like, okay, recently, I feel like I'm going to be making a lot of references, which means I'm the exact kind of person I hate, but I can't articulate how I feel about this film any other way. Recently, I sat down and watched through Satoshi Kon's 13-episode series, Paranoia Agent. It blew my mind. It made a huge impression on me, and not just because I was bedridden with the flu for 4 days. The whole idea of Paranoia Agent, though, is it asks the question about escapism, and especially the role of escapism in the present, because there are many people who will say, especially to people like you and me, David, why are you banging on about like the politics of representation in Father Goose? It's just meant to be entertaining. And I think in some respects, that's an argument you can always fall back on, and it's not an invalid argument. I think a movie like Paul Blart: Mall Cop certainly isn't designed to be consumed and dissected in a critical level, but at the same time, that doesn't give it a pass for things that it's doing. And I guess my question is, this film strikes me as a kind of wish fulfillment precisely due to that lack of growth and that lack of character. Because otherwise, I can be like, what else is this film? If it's a big joke about the impenetrability of sci-fi narratives and world building, like, okay, well, that's kind of funny, but does that necessitate tens of millions of dollars and 1 hour and 40 minutes on screen of just making that world more impenetrable as you go along?
Well, I would say number one, part of it is that's part of what the film's doing. And I mean, certainly, well, we can also bring that back to, does anything justify tens of millions of dollars being spent on it to make it? Like, again,
Apocalypse Now, baby!
well, but again, but I mean, certainly, let's come back to Paul Blart: Mall Cop. I think that film's vapid and useless, and yet, I can guarantee you it had a bigger budget than The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai behind it, and
And probably made more
it
back.
probably.
But I guess the question is, Dave, Paul Blart Mall Cop doesn't inspire that kind of rapturous fandom that Buckaroo Banzai does. And I guess for me, it's trying. Okay. I think in a lot of respects, I understand what this movie is trying to do. I think I understand who this film is oriented towards. But there's something, maybe it's because I myself, like, am no longer in that space. Because there, I will freely admit, there was a time in my life, and there may still be a time in my life, where this would have been, like, my favorite movie. You know, I'm not going to pretend that I don't get it, or I'm too hip for it, or that it's too problematic for me, or I'm holier than thou, or anything. People like what they like, you know, quality aside. I'm just really trying to understand what it is about this film that makes people respond to it so lovingly in ways that similar films do not.
I think a large part of it is the fact that, at least for me, and I can't speak for others in this instance, so much of why this film appeals to me is because it is so earnestly goofy and oddball and weird. And again, the attention to detail in terms of just the sheer oddness of this world while still making some degree of sense where if you where you can make sense of things. Like, again, the Hong Kong Cavaliers and their weird little inner dynamics. Like, the idea of Rawhide as played by Clancy Brown.
Clancy
Yeah,
Brown.
who has this sort of, it's like the old and wizened member of the team. You've got Matt Lewis, who, again, more and more is the scene stealer for me in this movie as Perfect Tommy. Who, again, just the sheer weird little details you find out about his existence and membership of the team, such as the fact that, you know, again, they have to warn him, it's like no strike teams, knowing that there is some weird little history there behind that he can't be part of this. Or the fact that, yes, the club owner knows who they all are and seems to be very aware of what he's doing. Or just even strange little sides, such as what's going on with the president in this movie, where, again, like the whole thing about it, again, in other forms of fiction, like, and particularly if you've seen things like, for example, this past summer's Dark Phoenix, the last lousy X-Men movie of the Fox era. Well, I guess New Mutants still.
Well, I didn't see it, and I don't think anyone else did
Probably
either.
not, but one of the things is that, yes, Charles Xavier has the phone that links him directly to the president in that thing. And we've all seen those numerous things where, yes, we get the conversation with the president in the Oval Office, where he's surrounded by his hangers-on, and he's making decisions, and everybody's got to go along with this. Or, you know, they're trying to give him proper advice, and they can't decide how they're going to handle this crisis situation. Well, yeah, we get the president in this film. It just so happens that simultaneously this is happening at a point where his back's gone out, so he's basically in this traction setup while still surrounded in this little low-rent hospital room as opposed to the Oval Office. It's a simple gag, but it makes me smile. And then watching Buckaroo and crew company try to explain to him what's going on, and his responses as he tries to piece together the lunacy that they're feeding him while still accepting it at face value. Like, even, like, just throwaway lines like, "What is it you're talking about, man? Some kind of race war in New Jersey?" Only because he can't actually piece together the impenetrability of this plot line and the very insular dynamics of the Banzai Institute, as it were.
Well, see, I do like that because, you know, that is one of the few moments where the film is like it's more clearly self-reflexive in its humor, where it's like, you know, if anyone sat down, like it took us about 35 minutes to explain what the plot of this movie even is. And yeah, like even within the universe, trying to tell people what's going on, it makes no sense because there are so many strange details. It's like, wait, so there are two different kinds of Lectroids that come from a numbered planet in a numbered dimension, and there's a woman named John? Oh, they're all named John.
Exactly.
It's just the problem is, I feel like a lot of its highbrow humor is met by comparatively lowbrow humor, and I'll get into that in a moment. It's just, I guess the problem for me is that watching this film for the first time in 2019 and thinking about that kind of dedicated, geeky, presumably white, because this is not a very diverse
No, it is
film.
not.
You know, like what does it say, David, when in 1984, a movie that's supposed to be about interdimensional travel and about how, you know, everything that you can possibly fathom is so much smaller than what's out there that the only black characters we get are literally codified as aliens and referred to as Rasta dudes.
And like I said, I'm not going to sit here and say that this is a film that isn't problematic. Let's be clear. For example, I love Peter Weller's performance as the title character. But
he doesn't look half Japanese.
And that's
does
the
he,
thing.
David?
As far as I can tell, Peter Weller has no Japanese ancestry, and yet Buckaroo Banzai is supposed to be a biracial character. I would say if you're doing this film now, yes, you would do change that. And I'm not sitting there saying that as a way to give this film a pass, because no, it's problematic. There are failings in it. There's certainly
And I'm not saying that it necessarily sinks the film either. I'm just saying in 2019, especially watching this film sort of when you and I in the course of our show have watched it, these are questions we ask of other films, and it's hard to ignore that, especially when the film makes it a point to indicate that he does have biracial heritage. The fact that, you know, Dr. Ito, Robert Ito's character, is his mentor and everything. That his band is called the Hong Kong Cavaliers, even though they're all a bunch of lily white dudes. You know, it strikes me as very strange. And that's not to say that this is necessarily a film that perpetuates stereotypes or is actively harmful, but that feels weird because especially like it gets weirdly close to Orientalism where it's like his Japanese heritage is just there as another quirk. When you're taking cultural histories and just treating them like another attribute a character can wear, I don't really care for that as a viewer. And that kind of tempers how much I can be like, this is just fun. Let's kick up our heels and enjoy the ride.
There are moments where, yes, it does veer towards it. What I would say, though, is that the film also very patently puts it at a, or doesn't emphasize it to the degree that it could into more dangerous territory. Let's put it this way. For the most part, we see Buckaroo walking around in that amazingly tailored gray suit with a bow tie and a blue shirt, which Peter Weller wears the hell out of, I'm going to sit there and say.
Yeah, the man looks good in a suit, metal or otherwise.
Exactly. And it's one of those things where, again, I like the sort of quirkiness of the idea that, while, yes, I would certainly say if we were doing Buckaroo Banzai in 2019, no, you cast a Japanese-American actor or biracial actor in the role.
Or at least Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, God. You really had to go there, didn't you? But
hey, Hollywood went there first.
Well, yes. But my point being, in the case of this film, I would certainly change it. But for 1984, and what was comparatively it was doing, again, the idea of Buckaroo Banzai is, particularly in the era of the hard-bodied hero, and the idea of, again, going back to the roots of what this character is sort of referencing and homaging to. I mean, let's not forget, Doc Savage, probably his closest analog to this, was the Man of Bronze. He had that big, muscular chest, and let's not forget that that was a character that for years people had talked about the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger or Dwayne Johnson playing on screen. In the case here, who's our hero? Well, it's Peter Weller, the skinny guy who wears glasses and wanders around like a proto Matt Smith playing the Doctor from years before that ever happened. And that's the kind of thing where it's like those little weird touches I find enjoyable or appealing. And again, I'm not going to sit here and make any great claims to Buckaroo Banzai being an immensely in-depth or nuanced film. It's not. And it is certainly, again, I think it does make some good points about the sort of cult, the weird cult worship that this world has towards him. I find hilarious.
But I don't think that the film problematizes that sort of cult of personality around him. And I mean, that's okay, because from what we see in the film, Buckaroo Banzai is a very kind, a very empathetic person. He can effectively do no wrong.
Yes.
And that is what I find kind of unsettling about this film, only because we have seen many, many stories in the news about people reacting very violently because, you know, being raised as a white, awkward teenager, you end up feeling like it's only a matter of time one day that the world is going to recognize how great you are. And when that doesn't happen, people lash out in violent and horrific ways. And I'm not saying that Buckaroo Banzai is directly or even indirectly responsible for that, but there's a certain echo when watching this. Because in 2019, it is very strange that regardless of sort of the narrative tradition that it's kind of trying to emulate and lovingly embrace. Like, I'm not saying that this is a film that is racist or classist or misogynistic, and I certainly don't think it intends to do any of the things that I'm dinging it for. But the problem is there were a number of junctures where I had to step back and admit to myself, like, the second half of this film, I was less interested in because I'm like, but I'm watching a white dude who is great at everything, be celebrated by everyone, have everyone defer to his authority and his expertise to save the day, and then promise another adventure where we get to do it all over
again. But at the same time, this is a film that is overtly a comedy about that. The degree to which we're taking that at face value as, you know, this is, you know, again, it's not saying that it's to say that that isn't there, but it's also one of those things where deliberately this is an absurd world where we're watching absurd things happen, and it's built around increasingly amping up to the absurdity where, yes, our hero ends up delivering, you know, when he's asked about the serious issue of whether everything's okay with the alien spaceship or should the president just go ahead and blow up Russia. His response is yes on one and no on two, which leads to the confusion of what message are we actually sending back to the president, or are we accidentally going to start World War III over this?
I think the reason why this film works the way it does owes largely to Weller's performance, because there is something unmistakably likable about how he portrays the character. There is something unmistakably cool about his outfits, about the fact that, you know, he can effortlessly go from experimental engine prototypes to neurosurgery to, without missing a beat, picking up a Fender Stratocaster and just doing a blues solo. Like, there is something goofy about this, and there's a lot in this film that I do like and I want to like more. But I guess it's just, I feel like the satiric element is much more geared towards sort of speculative fiction slash world building series as a whole than it really satirizes the idea of hero worship and the cult of personality. And I think this is not the film's fault that The Life Aquatic came out afterwards and I saw The Life Aquatic first, but something like The Life Aquatic is all about the inverse of that, where, if anything, it's hard to believe why people would listen to someone like Steve Zissou in the first place, because all we see are their failings and their faults. And all the people who once believed in him realize, oh yeah, you're kind of a drip and we don't like you anymore. But I feel like there's something more to be learned or discovered, or a sort of vulnerability that leads me to care about the proceedings much more than I was able to get invested in Buckaroo Banzai.
But I would also say that these are two, for whatever their connections are, and they are clearly there, they're also two radically different films. Like, and to me, this is...
They are. I mean, they're kind of cousins passing on opposite trains.
Yeah.
There is overlap between them, but I certainly don't want to frame it like The Life Aquatic is a remake or a strict homage to The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Well, I'm just looking at this and sitting there and imagining it's like watching, what was the film starring Joaquin Phoenix and Josh Brolin from a few years ago, which is effectively a sort of neo-noir send-up.
Was it Walk the Line?
Wasn't Walk the Line. I'm blanking on what it was. But I mean, again, it's a very dense, layered, nuanced film. And then you go back and you take a look at the naked...
Inherent Vice?
Yes, I think it's Inherent Vice, yes. And then you'll go back and try and say, well, yeah, but the Naked Gun wasn't doing the same thing. It's like, well, no, they're not. They're just two completely different beasts, but both are drawing upon a very noir tradition to completely opposite ends. And Buckaroo Banzai while it certainly doesn't go Zucker Abrams Zucker in terms of its approach, it is far closer in tone to being a romp movie than it is anything looking to give a nuanced look and critique of the genre or anything else. This is a film built around the notion of We're here to have fun and play around in the genre that we love, and we recognize it's frequently absurd. And again, I think when you look at the fact that W.D. Richter's previous credits, this is somebody who clearly knows his sci-fi. He knows the genre he's playing with. The fact that he brought on Jordan Cronenweth as his cinematographer, again, the man who made Blade Runner look as gorgeous as it is, indicates that this is somebody who clearly knows the history of what he's playing with. Likewise, I mean, there's such enough weird details. So, again, from the idea of, we're going to reference back to Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938 as a significant plot point, which leads to that amazing shot of Jeff Goldblum having the horrified reaction that maybe, just maybe, the War of the Worlds broadcast was real, and the idea of it just being a prank was a cover-up after the fact, and delivering it stone-faced while the music builds with that ominous hum behind it is gut-bustingly hysterical to me as we go through it.
Well, yeah, especially how, like, the slow reveal when they're going through the records and they find out, wait a second, on the same date as the War of the Worlds broadcast, what is it, 38 different people with the first name John registered for their social security number.
Exactly.
In, what is it, Cooper's Mill?
Grove's Mill. Grover's Mill.
Grove's Mill, yeah. It's just, like... The problem is, I feel like if you are not equally appreciative of the long and very, very winding history of sci-fi and speculative fiction in genre cinema, is there much that's going to pull you into this film?
Absolutely
not. Because
I
feel like, well, because the risk is, though, you have Richter and co. being like, hey guys, wasn't it great when Doc Savage did this? Or, hey, look at this scene, everybody, we're referencing this. Though it's never quite as tacky or egregious to, like, do a straight up lift or anything like that. But I feel like at the same time, it leads us again to that same argument that people keep making over and over, which is like the insularity of nerd fandom, where it's like, oh, well, we're part of the secret sci-fi boys club, and this is a film for us, and if you don't get it, well, that's too bad. You don't get to be a member.
Well, but to me, that's also no different than looking back on the modernist writers whose whole credo was, look, I spend all this time learning about all this classic literature and referencing it homages in the wasteland, and you need to put as much work into it as I did in order to understand it. Otherwise, you're just not going to get it, and therefore, you are somehow lesser. That's the exact same mindset. The only difference is that we're dealing with...
I agree with you completely,
yeah.
But the era of modernity is over, and I think we've all moved on from the idea that James Joyce has to be the best writer because he can mash together gobbledygook in five different languages in a paragraph.
But what I would say then, also to the response to that, is that, no, this is not a film for everybody. Does it have to be, though? And that's the thing where it's like, yeah, it's doing absolutely everything you're saying, but does that inherently make it worth less in the grand scheme of things to art that is trying to be, quote-unquote, more accessible to anybody else or have a more utilitarian thing? I mean, this is the kind
of... I don't think it tempers the quality of the film at all. Yeah. I just think when you make this kind of film and it ends up being a spectacular flop, it's kind of hubris when the film, before its release, just is bookended with, you know, the promise of a future film in the series to come. And I think the idea of, like, making fun of the impenetrability of narratives, I feel like that's an idea that would work better if it's developed over several films, but that idea has to go somewhere. Instead, we had one, and it ends up... Like, there's a lot about this film I like, and just because I don't think I'm its intended audience, that doesn't make it a bad movie. Like, it's a more than competent film, I think, especially for 1984. Like, the effects work, like, the practical effects they do are pretty good. Like, that first warp into the eighth dimension...
Yeah.
It's not a complicated or expensive shot. Instead, like, we get the photo negative and, like, the camera panning across it and sort of distorting the dimensions of the geometry. Like, it's a very interesting shot, and it's really effective. And I can almost guarantee that they pulled it off for a fraction of the cost that, like, building a set of the eighth dimension would have ever cost them. Like, it's clever in the way that it makes itself look good without looking cheap. You know, like, this doesn't seem like the kind of film where they went way over budget or way over scale, despite, you know, the fact that the studio hired its own Bond company stooge to supervise. Like, it does a lot of things well. And I guess, if anything, maybe it's just that I'm jealous that I don't get to be in that club.
Well, I mean, it's the thing. It's not a film for everybody, and I would never make the claim. And look, if you don't enjoy the film, I will say this to anybody, that's absolutely fine. I admit, there's stuff that this film isn't going to, that will not appeal to people. And there's stuff where, yeah, you can see that W.D. Richter is a first-time filmmaker and doesn't quite work. I love what he does here, but he's also clearly not an action director. Or director, because you see scenes such as, again, Buckaroo being chased down in the middle of the night by a thing when a helicopter, rope glider comes out and grabs him. The way it's shot and edited is a bit clunky, without question. Everything's a little bit too slow. The edits are a bit too long. Nothing quite gels together in those moments. And yeah, it's because
Yeah, and like the climactic scene on the spaceship, it feels chaotic, but not in a way that lends the scene urgency, just in a way that, again, I know it's not a technical term, but it does feel clunky. And like that final exchange between Christopher Lloyd's character and the Lithgow character, where they go from arguing about names to Lithgow pulling out a gun and shooting him, but it's uninterrupted, and like the fact that there are no beats, like it doesn't resonate as nearly as funny as it probably seemed on paper. And I think that's mostly in the delivery, or sort of the construction of that. Timing is everything.
Well, and that's the thing. I think Richter, I mean, this is certainly, there's a lot of hallmarks of being a first-time director where, yeah, you get the sense he's learning on the job as he goes. And I'm sure if he, you know, this wasn't his first movie, you know, if he'd shot one or two things prior to this, he probably would have had a bit more control and been able to pick up the pace a little bit. And certainly there's part of me that would wonder what would happen if this had been directed by somebody with a bit more control, and a bit more, confidence as a filmmaker shooting us. At the same time, the amount of what he pulls off, despite being a first timer, is just immense in terms of, yeah, getting this particular cast and getting the cast to gel this well over the course of it. Because, I mean, again, there is not a single member of the Hong Kong Cavaliers that isn't a delight to watch in this film. Like, everybody gets their own weird little character beats and moments and oddball stuff to do.
All right, give me some examples, because we're like an hour 10, and I feel like we've barely said anything specific about this film at all. And that's my fault, because we watched Buckaroo Banzai to have a meta discussion about fandom. So go ahead, David. I don't want to rain on your parade. Why don't you list me a few of the things that work really, really well?
Okay, so certainly, I mean, again, everything that goes on with Matt Lewis's perfect Tommy in this film, the more I watch what he's doing and the more he play, I see how he's playing off of Peter Weller and the others, is just a delight, because he's very much the hardcore dedicated, you know, to everybody here, but he's also somebody with a bit of a sense of humor about himself throughout this whole thing. Like, even little touches such as Buckaroo when he's in the prison cell getting Penny out, telling Tommy,
Yes.
give her your coat. Why me? 'Cause you're perfect. You have a point there. His
And
delivery.
then he gives that wry little smile. Like, I really like that touch.
Yeah, or exactly. Or even little touches such as when they're again, when Buckaroo's going into yo-yo dying propulsion as part of the first plan of their attack, and he's basically getting himself kidnapped. When you see the Secretary of Defense show up, and there's Perfect Tommy sitting on a lawn chair outside of the Hong Kong Cavaliers travel slash tour bus. Again, it's just the detail. It's like, yeah, of course you would pull a lawn chair out and just wait until it was time to go into action for this. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, seems reasonable.
Yeah.
It's yeah. And I mean, like, I also feel like we've completely glossed over like the entire middle of this film as well. But yeah, like, I don't know. It's just, I really hate leaving discussions or just like my final conclusion being like, well, that's why they make different kinds of jelly beans. Because, you know, even without this film grabbing me, it does do a number of things well. Especially the first half of this film. I think I was really on board with it because I wasn't totally sure where it was going to go. I think by the time the plot reveals itself as a sort of proto They Live, I find that to me is actually less interesting than exploring the world, only because I feel like this is a film that by the time that narrative thrust makes itself clear, the film kind of locks itself in on rails, and we don't really, like, we see interactions between the characters, but we don't really get new wrinkles added. And I mean, I think it kind of comes down to, do you want to watch characters grow, or do you want to see them do cool things? And depending on the film, on the character, on the viewer, and on the day of the week, the answer is always going to be different. Maybe this film just caught me for the first time when I wasn't predisposed to get on board with it.
Well, this is the thing. Like, I mean, again, this is very much a love it or hate it film. You're either on board with what it's trying to do, and if you're not on board, that again, if probably by about the 30-minute mark, you're not digging this film, it's not going to improve for you. I mean, if you're not finding things such as the idea of, again, the big press conference happening where they're going to be talking about the fact that yes, interdimensional travel has been broken, and you get the immortal lines such as the introduction where I'll try to be quick in case you haven't noticed we have a motorcycle convention moving in, and let's face it, you didn't come here to listen to me talk. Where yes, the most amazing thing, the biggest scientific breakthrough in all time is happening, but we really got to clear out of here quickly because the
Yeah, for a
motorcycles.
motorcycle convention.
Exactly.
Like, I do like those little details because it makes it feel like a real world. But when all of a sudden things hit the fan, kind of recognizing that there's no real stakes or there's no real threat that Buckaroo won't be able to save the day or that he's less than perfect, like that makes the world seem a lot flatter than it sets itself up to be at first. Which is a shame because, like, I do want to be on board with this world. I do like just the bizarre series of affects that are on display there, and I think it could work. I think there's that's not to say that it doesn't beyond my own personal taste. It's just like I do love how Buckaroo Banzai just without missing a beat, they're like, telephone call, it's the president. Who? The president of the United States. Oh, okay. And just like the fact that nothing phases him. Like that's funny. It's deadpan. It's absurdist. I like it. The problem is, and again, point of comparison, Life Aquatic. That's a film that's about human emotions. You know, that's a film that has a clear journey and like a clear narrative arc, but ultimately it's about people coming to terms with something, and often coming to terms with just who they are and the choices they've made. There's never really that coming to terms moment in this film, because even the idea of Penny showing up, like before she even realizes what's going on, Buckaroo has already figured out that for reasons that go unexplained, she must be the twin sister of my dead wife. And it kind of, the way that that's all hand-waved away, it kind of feels like, oh, well, now you just have your old wife back, but better, because she's alive. And like, it just, there doesn't seem to really be anything at stake here. And again, we've seen films where there are really low stakes. And, you know, there doesn't always need to be. Paul Blart doesn't have stakes. Some people love that movie. I'm the kind of viewer, though, where without a sense of stakes or what is at stake, it's hard for me to understand, like, figure out for myself why I'm sitting here and watching
I
something.
would say then that this comes down to it where it again is the question of what is the kind of film we're watching here. And I would agree if this were a film where I was expecting, some sort of emotional resonance, or this is a film that was attempting those things. Like, one of my problems with things like, and again, I can't believe we're talking about Paul Blart, but again, looking at those films is the phony idea of we're supposed to care about Paul Blart and his thing, where it's, well, he's a regular guy, and oh, geez, we're supposed to care about his emotional, life and, his romantic relationships. Like, I don't care. And
Wait, are we? I haven't seen the movie,
I
so.
unfortunately had the misery of sitting through the second one in theaters, having mercifully skipped the first one, and I told my friend that I would never do that again. Point being.
Is that when you sent me a picture of the cinema screen when it said starring Neil McDonough? Because I'm pretty sure you texted me that at one
point. Oh, it was what, that's the, I will say this, that's the film I saw, which led to me reviewing it on the old Cinema Chase website, where I came up with the whole St. McDonough bit, because his ability to appear in more crap than anybody else, it seems, and so, almost to the point where it's like, he is doing this so that other actors don't have to suffer. Like, I can't explain Neil McDonough's returning presence in terrible, terrible movies, despite being actually a really good actor, but
he only shows up for the sequels. Yeah, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, this film also, you say that it, like a lot of people that I've encountered online, because this is a film you can very easily find many, many fans that will at least reach out the hand and sort of help you contextualize this film. And like, it doesn't seem to be a toxic fandom the same way that, say, other sci-fi properties have dragged out of the woodwork. Everybody seems pretty cool, and I think if you want to be one of the Blue Blazers, you know, you have to at least be a bit like Buckaroo himself and try to be nice to people. I do like that sentiment as well, but I don't know. Like, I feel like this is also a film that's very much of its time, where I think only in the early 1980s can a film like this come about in quite the way that it does. And I don't, like, the more I talk about it, the less and less I'm even sure of what to think. Because I really do, it's not that I think this is an ineptly made movie, but I feel like there's something deeper than just, it's not my cup of tea. Because it's an affect that I am trying to articulate. So Dave, I'm going to defer to you, and hopefully I can come up with words.
What I would say is, I mean, again, I think to sort of return to the point is that I don't think at any point in time we're supposed to be emotionally invested in what goes on in this movie. I think we're very much kept at a deliberate distance, and it's all part and parcel of what goes on. And let's talk about things like the whole sequel bait thing. While we do know that, yes, you know, they'd hoped that they wanted to make a sequel, the sequel bait also works perfectly well as a final gag in this film as well, where stay tuned for Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League. In a way, I'm kind of happy there isn't a sequel, because, yeah, that stands as a really great gag where, yes, there's another weird, strange adventure that'll probably be just as absurd as anything we saw here in this movie. And things like the whole Penny, you know, subplot involving her looking like Buckaroo's wife, like Buckaroo's late wife, and possibly being her twin sister. A, the fact that Buckaroo can toss that off, and that's probably the rational explanation for what's happened, is, I think, in and of itself funny, because everybody just sort of goes along with that and takes that at face value. But number two, again, I also look at that and think about things like the whole Madeline Pryor subplot from, again, the X-Men comics, where, oh, Jean Grey's dead, but hey, Cyclops has met this woman who looks exactly like Jean Grey, and how is that possible? Why is he fixated? Is it Jean back from the dead? And no, it's not the case. And the increasingly convoluted explanations. Yeah.
Who cares? She looks like Jean, but she can't start fighters with her brain, so everybody wins.
Yeah, and eventually goes on to become like, you know, it turns out she's a clone by Mr. Sinister, who eventually becomes possessed by these demonic forces from Limbo, who then turn her into the Goblin Queen, and then she causes Inferno on Earth. And it's like, again, when you read the books and follow year by year going through it, it builds to that, you know, that world building makes sense when you get there. When you just drop somebody in and say, well, here's, you know, the Inferno arc, have at it. Again, who on their right mind is going to be able to make sense of that? And I love the fact that this film's entire approach is like, yeah, there's nothing that this film's doing that's really all that more absurd than what's going on in any number of things that we read straight. Like, again, and I say this as somebody who's...
Well, also, I mean, compare what's going on in Buckaroo Banzai to a film like Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, where characters in both films talk in pseudoscientific language. They try and talk about how the fantastical is actually quite possible, and they make absurd leaps of logic. The difference is, in Buckaroo Banzai, we're supposed to laugh at how silly that is. And in Christopher Nolan's films, we're never allowed to.
Well, and that's exactly it. I think that, again, that's the thing I love about this movie, is it's, I don't look at it as it really is just a loving homage and send-up of those things where you could tell that these were probably just a few people getting together and like, yeah, hey, we all enjoyed this stuff growing up. We all enjoy reading these things. You know, what if we just push it and make it that much sillier? To the point where, yeah, we have people wrapping what appears to be bubble wrap around their head as specialty glasses to watch, you know, the holographic projection of Rosalind Cash as the leader of this alien race, or Carl Lumley.
Well, as you bring up Rosalind Cash, though, I'm saying when they're like, hey, books that we all love, movies that we all love.
Yeah.
And when that we is a group of largely heterosexual Caucasian men on screen in decent positions in Hollywood, it's like, yes, is that the royal we, though?
Well, no, and I'm not saying that that's the case, but I also wouldn't sit there and point to Buckaroo.
But this is also not the only sci-fi property to have difficulties or sort of problems getting the balance right when it comes to representation of non-white characters.
Well, and that's my thing,
so
yeah.
I certainly don't want to make it sound like Buckaroo Banzai is the only film where this is a problem. Because it's not. I mean, that's a much larger issue and has been written about in much more grounded and nuanced terms than I think I'm capable of delivering now.
And it's the thing where, look, I mean, again, and I say this as somebody who loves Peter Weller's performance in the film, I wish that the creators had been able to push through in 1984 getting a biracial actor to play the role. Because I love the notion that, you know, at least in terms of the diegesis of this world, that who is it that America all comes to love in this thing? It is the biracial action hero. It's just, you kind of wish it was actually a biracial action hero playing the role.
And like, that would be a simple change that I think would just be so much more palatable. Because, you know, you can call him Buckaroo Banzai, you can have him put on the Rising Sun headband, but it's Peter Weller. Yes, he's handsome. Yes, he can be a terrific actor. There is nothing about Peter Weller that scans as anything less than like 100% Nordic in his feet.
Well, and that's it. And I say this, and that's the thing where it's like, if you were to do something with Buckaroo Banzai today, now in this time period, if you cast a completely Caucasian actor in the role, absolutely protest the hell out of that, because that is ridiculous. And that's not to say that it wasn't ridiculous in 1984. I'm also saying that around this exact same time, let's not forget that we also had The Adventures of Remo Williams coming out, where you had...
I don't know what that is, but I'm probably not going to like what you're about to
say. Well, let's put it this way. Yellowface. There we go.
Okay.
So you have that. And you also had, again, not too long before that, again, and I say this to somebody who likes the idea, who enjoys the film Murder by Decree, but yeah, there's also flippin' Peter Sellers in Yellowface playing a Charlie Chan-esque character in that thing. There's no getting around that. Hollywood at this point in time would have been the fact that they didn't insist on Peter Weller having that kind of facial makeup applied to him is at least better than what was going on at the time. That doesn't make it right. It just means it's marginally better than what we could have expected out of Hollywood at that point in time.
Well, even out of sci-fi in general, because, I mean, especially around the time that this comes out, I'm thinking of certain work, like, a lot of sci-fi novels, especially in the early 1980s, especially with the advent of, like, cyberpunk narratives and things like that, you take a step back and you realize, well, a lot of it is guys named Philip and William telling stories about how Japan is truly the future. And it ends up being like a really well-meaning Orientalism, but I think that's an issue that's more endemic to sci-fi of that period than anything else. The problem is when you're making a loving homage to sci-fi, but you're so loving that you're not critical in issues beyond the fact that plots can sometimes get kind of complicated. Maybe not the best target for your knives, I guess.
I think that it keeps its aims modest. I'm not just sitting there saying that there isn't a more insightful and, you know, critical science fiction satire that could be made. There certainly is. But I don't think that that was ultimately, again, in terms of the goals of what this film actually set out to achieve, I think it hits most of them quite well. And Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins, actually comes out in 1985, and it's actor Joel Grey, who's buried under makeup, Chichikona.
Wait, Joel Grey? He's even less Asiatic featured than Peter Weller. No, sorry, I am not going to suddenly get into an argument over which white guy is better at being Asian.
Well, my point being, and then Roddy McDowall would play the same character in the failed pilot for the Remo Williams television series, because, again, 1988 Hollywood still hadn't improved at all. But, yeah. We'll put the pin in the Remo Williams, because I'm pretty sure eventually James will want to join us in on that one. So let us know, James.
Yeah, I was going to say, this wraps up another episode of Yammering About Yellowface with Andrew and Dave. Okay, maybe steering back to Buckaroo Banzai. Dave, I mean, at least, like, this is a film that I figured I would probably have a pretty visceral reaction to. And I wouldn't say I had a visceral reaction. Rather, I just had a reaction that I'm still kind of confused by. That being said, you threw out our friendship. I have never once doubted that you understand what this film is trying to do. It was also your pick. This has been a film you've wanted to do for quite some time. I will defer the final words on Buckaroo Banzai to you.
I will say that, look, I am not going to pretend that this is a film for everybody. I'm not going to pretend that this isn't a film with some problematic elements. They're there, folks. I will not argue that one bit here. I also think that if you enjoy the same kind of weird minutia that, like myself, and are interested in things like, hey, the career of Orson Welles and what he was doing before he was over in Franco, Spain, that's the sort of thing where, yeah, you might be the target audience for this thing. You know, again, and this is a film that also features things like a very unique and interesting synth score, of which at least one track will be stuck in your head before all is said and done.
Oh, yes. You'll be mad at first, and then you'll realize you can't live without it.
Exactly. It is a film that features so many beautiful, cutaway, quotable dialogue that will just, you know, you can just drop at the pin of a hat. And again, there's so much stuff we didn't even talk about, like Penny's reaction to Buckaroo later on, when she thinks he's freaking out about the fact that she went into his room without his permission. It's like, you like Jerry Lewis? You give me a hope to carry on? Then you leave me in the lurch when you strap on your six guns? Like, just, I don't know why I find that funny, but I find that incredibly, incredibly funny. Or little throwaway gags in the background, such as the asylum's speaker system announcing lithium is no longer available on credit.
I mean, it's slightly better than the PA gags in Street Fighter.
Well, but that's it. I mean, like, you know, there's just so much weird, little, delightful stuff going on in this movie that, if any of this sounds kind of funny to you or interesting, again, come take a look at the movie. It's worth your, at the very least, it's worth a watch. If you don't like it, that's fine. But like I said, at least give it the chance to sit there and see whether it's of your taste or not. Because worst comes to worst, all you can sit there and say, well, it's not the worst thing I've ever seen. Because, you know, Paul Blart Mall Cop is still out there. So.
Well, I think as well, when you hear the words, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, that should tell you exactly what this film is. And to its credit, it never tries to be anything that it isn't. So, I mean, we've now looked at a number of films in a row that are very culty, that tend to be consistently one note in their tonality, and, you know, they're all films that aim to be either satirical or comic to varying degrees. And, I mean, in that regard, Buckaroo Banzai is certainly no worse than the recent offerings that we've looked at. Because, yeah, it's a polarizing film. It is, you know, something you're either going to love or you're going to hate. And you're going to know right away what side of the line you're on. That being said, if you are on the side of the line that is either really curious or already a fan of this, dig in, because it's dense enough that it can hold up for repeat viewings, and there's certainly no shortage of things going on with it. It's the kind of film where I could see why, if you respond to it, like, there's a lot to unpack there. And, you know, if you are the kind of fan that enjoys Buckaroo Banzai, I don't begrudge you. If you're the kind of fan that does not care for it because it's fanciful and formalism for its own sake, I understand that too. I guess the only thing I don't understand is what I think, and maybe that means it's the opportune moment to get to our patent-punting bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we talk about the little things. Granted, this episode has been 90 minutes of us talking about the little things because there's no way we could talk about the complete plot mechanics of this film and keep it under 7 hours. So, Dave, what is the first standout that you would like to celebrate this film for the first hit?
Should I steal the one that I'm pretty confident is going to be yours, or should I leave you to that one?
Surprise me.
All right. I'll actually leave you the one I'm fairly confident that you're going to select, and I am definitely going to be giving a shout-out to actor Matt Lewis again, because, again, of all the amazing people in this cast, because, again, this thing is filled with character actors and stars like nobody's business. Matt Lewis is probably not the most notable name in that cast. But, again, every time I watch this, more and more I am focusing on what he is doing in the background of scenes and how he's reacting to everybody around him. And he is all in a very different way. He is just as deadpan in his reactions as Peter Weller, while still being more expressive and youthful in his approach to things. And again, the way in which he just confidently wears some of the ridiculous outfits they give him over the course of this movie to wear, including, yeah, the suit jacket with no shirt combo that he has to prowl around in.
He wears it well.
Exactly. And it's like, it's just those weird little touches to what's going on. And again, even little exchanges such as, when they start talking about Emilio Lizardo, and he's like, hey, wasn't he on TV? No, you're thinking of Mr. Wizard. Yeah, that was a TV scientist, doofus. Well, or Emilio Lizardo was a scientist, doofus. He goes, Mr. Wizard was a scientist as well. Like, just his, like, no inflection, no deadpan. It's just like, no, I know he was a scientist as well. Don't you forget. Like, just...
Exactly. We're a cool band, and we're all brilliant, and we're also going to bicker over trivia. Oh, yes, and Mr. Wizard was someone we once encountered. I mean, I do like that, and it's, again, I think the reason it works is because, you know, they're sort of doing strange affects for your character for the camera and chewing the scenery. Whereas, Lewis, you're right, very often, like, it's the background details that he's doing, and it feels like that's very much being done for the attentive viewer. And I think it's a bit more charming that way and funnier when you do notice it. And, yeah, I mean, this film certainly has no shortage of details and things going on at all times. Just the moments where I did laugh out loud, you're right, I mean, Matt Lewis generally was in those, so... Yeah, hats off to him.
Yeah, but what about you, Andrew? What is yours? And I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to call it, but I'll let you go ahead.
I have two, and you can probably call them both.
Okay.
The big one that you clearly know is the ending credits.
Yes.
Sequence, which very strongly echoed in The Life Aquatic, whose credit sequence I absolutely adore as well. Here we get something that I think is actually even more interesting. Because what begins with, apparently it's like an aqueduct that they drain somewhere in California, but we just get like this wonderful zoom out of Buckaroo Banzai in his suit just walking as the most delightful minimal drumbeat and synth whistle starts playing. And it just plays like this wonderfully simple riff that apparently is the same tempo of Uptown Girl. And then just as he's walking, all the various characters of the Hong Kong Cavaliers and friends and foe, they all end up walking alongside until it's just this whole mass of people. And then they suddenly walk laterally past a wall where Buckaroo Banzai is spray painted onto it. And it just holds that shot. There's just something very pleasing about the sound and the aesthetics working in tandem there. And also, it may have felt like I spent this entire episode banging on against nerd culture. You throw minimalist synths onto anything, and I turn into a bigger nerd than all of you combined. So that was the one moment where the film really hit my escapist pleasure button. It's a perfect, like, standalone scene. It is instantly memorable. And, I mean, you're bound to have seen something that paid lip service in the years since.
Yeah, absolutely. On a completely different note, and one, you know, we didn't really get to talk about this because, yeah, this is mostly in the middle of the movie, which you're right, Andrew. We sort of glossed over to an extent. But when it turns out that Buckaroo ends up asking people for help on the CB, and they put out the call to the Blue Blazer regulars, this leads us to the introduction of Scooter Libby and his father. And this is one of those details I love, again, in terms of just the strange world building of this film, where, again, there's a support network of people who are just hanging by the radio, just in case Buckaroo needs help. And yeah, when that call goes out, Scooter and his dad take their personal helicopter, and I love the fact that Scooter walks outside, you know, Buckaroo, Dad, Buckaroo needs help, and you just cut to the reaction shot, and for some reason, there's a pile of couches behind them. Nobody explains. There's no question and answers to what's happening there, but yes. And yeah, for the rest of the movie, even though they help out, they drop Buckaroo off at the, you know, his compound, they're invited in, no questions asked, to carry on the rest of the adventure with them, you know, for no discernible reason, which eventually leads to, yes, the delightful image of, you know, the small child keeping Secretary of Defense Matt Clark at bay from Buckaroo's car with, what is it, a pump action shotgun or something to that effect?
I believe so.
Yes. I'm pretty sure in this day and age.
And they test fire, so you know it's real.
Yeah, and I love the fact that in this day and age, that shot would never make it into the movie. Not in a million years, because who gives a child a firearm to play with? But, oh my.
Yeah, it's better to let Cypress Hill show up and provide backup.
Exactly. But I just, again, I love the fact that it's like, yep, no, this is a world in which, yeah, you know, neurosurgeons and scientists and rock and rollers and, you know, everyday folks can just all come together. And, oh yeah, we're going to fend off an alien invasion by space Nazis. So again, if that's the sort of thing that appeals to you folks, by all means, jump on in with this one. So what about you, Andrew? What would be your second pick for this one?
I would probably say my second hit is the scene where Penny is introduced and the entire club jam that happens.
Yeah.
Where just apropos of nothing, we suddenly see Buckaroo and the Cavaliers just strolling into the club, being mobbed by fans, and they just get on stage without missing a beat and just launch into, like, the most generic good time blues rock. And, like, it's just, there's something, I think it's also just because personally I love any TV show where people solve mysteries and are also in a band. You know, and it's just like, I like that, but then it gives way to Ellen Barkin's introduction.
Yeah.
And I want to give a nod to her because she's an amazing actress, and not just because also I really want to buy a dog now so I can name it Ellen Barkin. But Penny is basically the only character that emotes in this movie. And, you know, it's kind of a double edge because her character is pretty flat, largely relegated to second tier for most of the narrative. But in those little moments of her just crying and Peter Weller as Buckaroo talking to her without that, oh, there, you silly woman. Like, he actually sounds genuine, and it feels like the facade of deadpan absurdism slips a little. And then he gives that wonderfully brief and just very sweet, it's important to be nice to each other, and wherever you go, that's where you are. And, like, there's something earnest about that scene, and in spite of me shaking my head or throwing up my hands and saying why at later points in the movie, that scene at least indicates to me that this film's heart is in the right place, sometimes in spite of itself.
Well, and I also love with Ellen Barkin as well. I mean, as her character goes on, like, there's just, again, weird little details where suddenly she's picking up on scientific concepts and is able to fire back just as rapidly as anybody else. And based on everything we've seen, all we seem to know is that she was in a bad place and drinking in a bar previous to this in that weird frilly pink dress. Like, I'm not even sure how to properly describe that thing.
But at the same time, it's like, well, you seem nice, so come along with us. Here, sit in at our press conference and answer some questions on how my invention works. And the best part is, she can do it.
Well, exactly, and I love the...
I just wish the film gave her more to do.
And I, like I said, I would... again, why I'm also... part of me's kind of happy a sequel never happened, because I don't know whether they'd be able to make this work in the long run. I'm also kind of sorry that it didn't happen, because, yeah, I would love to see most of this cast back together and firing off with one another, or seeing what other weird strangers would suddenly jump in, because you can almost guarantee it, like, half of these people probably wouldn't show back up again, for one reason or another, probably due to how on earth are we going to schedule everybody to be in the same place again. But...
yeah. I mean, the fact they did it once is no small miracle.
Exactly. But, on that note, we should probably turn to the pits here. And, Andrew, I'm going to let you have... take first stab at this. What is something you would say certainly doesn't work for you in the smaller details, perhaps, of this film?
Well, yeah, like, I know that I've been the wet blanket for this episode, and I'm actually trying to make more of an effort to be a more positive person lately, so I might not be able to come up with the requisite two pits. However, there is a pit that I haven't mentioned, and it's grating enough that I think it comes very close to ruining the film for me. John Lithgow's performance as Dr. Lizardi. Because for all the film's cleverness with what it's trying to do, its villain is John Lithgow wearing prosthetic gross teeth and speaking in the most exaggerated Italiana mamma mia accent. And... It makes it impossible to take it seriously, and not in the sense that this film is really highbrow in the first place, but, like, it just comes off as, like, oh, well, it's ridiculous because Italian people sound funny. It feels like a very old, old trope that it's playing off of. And, like, I have encountered some people that think, like, oh, Lizardi is one of the funniest characters, like, I've seen in movies. I don't see it, because most of it is just him, like, speaking in malapropisms and arguing with Christopher Lloyd, because the one character's last name, everybody keeps pronouncing as Big Booty, and, you know, that's hilarious, I guess, because, you know, if I learned anything from Groucho Marx, nothing's funnier than somebody with a funny last name. Like... I don't know. Those are moments where it feels very, very dated, and not in a good throwback homage way. More in, these are some relics we should have left behind.
See, funny enough, I was actually going to have a pit with the villains as well, but it wasn't going to be Lithgow's Lord John Worfen or Emilio Lizardo, depending upon what you want to refer to him as. It's the, like, because I think I can see where his performance will rub people the wrong way. It's very broad, and it's very, very cartoonish. What I would say I think is a bigger disappointment for me, though, is you have Christopher Lloyd, Dan Hedaya, and Vincent, and I know I'm going to botch the pronunciation of his last name here, so allow me to at least, you know, screw it up while actually looking.
I believe it's Chiavelli.
Chiavelli, yes. You know, they basically play the sort of three, I guess, main lackeys for Worfen throughout this film. And unfortunately, they're not given much to do. Like, you get this, like, the first time I watched this film, I was getting the sense, or at least first, that I figured maybe in the case of Christopher Lloyd's Boutte character, putting aside the lame joke involving his last name, is that the idea is that he really, I thought at first, like, oh, this is the guy who doesn't actually want to be involved in an evil plan. He really just wants to run Yo-Yo Dine Systems and get over all this crap, but is stuck dealing with...
yeah, because they certainly allude to that thread.
Yeah.
But it ultimately goes nowhere because, well, he's still with Lizardi at the climax, and then they argue about how his name is pronounced, and then Lizardi shoots him.
Well, exactly. And there's, like, I mean, little bits and pieces of funny business where you got Lloyd playing off of Matt Clark, where Clark is wandering in, he clearly comes across Penny being, you know, put into this torture device, and he doesn't react so much as it's like, look, you can do whatever you do with your personal time is fine, but I'm here to see a bomber. And but
exactly,
yeah, but
you're building this bomber on contract for the government, and I'm not leaving until I see.
Yeah,
that's not a bomber.
Well, that's the thing. It's like Matt Clark's the one that gets to be funny in those scenes, though. Lloyd doesn't really get anything to do, and Dan Hedaya in particular, like, look, when you get Dan Hedaya in a movie, I'm happy. I love Dan Hedaya. He has literally nothing to do in this film, though. I can't even think of a bit of funny business he even gets to engage in.
I can't even remember a line of spoken dialogue that he has.
Well, and I think the one line he gets is when he's in the alien makeup. So you can, it takes a moment to even register that, yeah, it's him saying it. But again, you know, it's not particularly memorable. It's not particularly funny. And again, it's great that you got Dan Hedaya there, I'm not complaining about that, but if you're gonna have Dan Hedaya, give him something to do, please. So that's...
Yeah, 1984, because he would have been in Commando by now, so we know at least he can die in a memorable way.
I think Commando's like 88. Yeah.
Well, once again, bad film studio.
I think he was in Cheers, however, by that point, so...
Between me and W.D. Richter, who's truly the buffoon? Dave, I know it may be difficult, but can you think of anything else that you want to condemn? Or should we just wrap up Buckaroo Banzai and the Eighth Dimension for this?
Well, I was going to let you have your turn to do your second pit here, but...
Nah, that's about it.
I guess the only other thing I can really... sort of take, I don't want to say attack at this point, but again, I like the way, most of the way that this film looks. I like most of the way it's edited, but there are points where editor George Bowers and Richard Marx, who are not insignificant talents. I mean, Bowers was the editor on A League of Their Own and the Hughes Brothers from Hell, while Marx was one of the several editors on Apocalypse Now and also would go on to do Pennies from Heaven and Dick Tracy. Again, very talented cats.
And he also wrote that Wherever You Go, Whatever You Do song.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but the key thing here is you get things such as, like, there's just some weird editing choices where it feels like they're maybe just padding out time. Like, there's a moment where, yeah, Buckaroo's in the motorcycle chase, and you see the slow shot of the Yo-Yo Dine van going past. And then a few moments later, you see the shot of Buckaroo coming to the same spot, and very gradually riding around in his motorcycle, looking and deciding which way to go. And it feels like, number one, you probably intended to make that more dynamic, but you really couldn't have Peter Weller riding that fast for insurance purposes. In which case, you just should have cut the shot. I mean, it really wasn't necessary for anything here, folks. But, I mean, it's just those little beats where you can tell that Richter isn't really... It was really... didn't have a handle on how to shoot action material, and his editors weren't helping him on that one either.
Well, also, for a film that's trying to do so much in terms of ideas, in terms of visuality, in terms of your storytelling, it's one thing to come up with a lot of ideas. It's another to integrate them into a cohesive viewing experience. So I can see why, from the hop, this would be a challenging film to put together. So, I mean, yeah, there are moments where the seams show a little bit.
Absolutely. But, again, for the most part, I mean, this is not really an action-heavy movie for the most part anyway. So, at that instance, it's a small pit, but it's there. But with that, yeah, I guess that brings us to the end here. And Andrew, I know you didn't really necessarily I don't want to say you didn't enjoy this week's film, but certainly it wasn't your preferred movie this week. So you're the one who's choosing us next week. Where are you taking us? Because you've got plenty of options to go from this point forward.
That's true. It's, again, we have no, it's daunting because now I feel like I have to choose wisely. But I think... In the interest of fairness, Dave, I am going to give W.D. Richter another shot.
Okay.
And in fact, it also dawned on me that this makes now episode 70? And there is one category of film, well, in fact, there are many, but there's one notable category of film that you and I have not looked at previously. And that, of course, is the vampire film.
Ah.
So we are going to rectify that by following W.D. Richter in our next episode to a little film that he wrote the screenplay for, directed by John Badham and starring Frank Langella. That's right, yet another adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes, yes, the film that tried to sell us on the idea that Frank Langella was this one sexy individual. Whether you agree or not, you decide. But yeah.
I didn't come around until Frost Nixon myself, but that's going to be an interesting one, and... Well, if you've learned anything from this episode, Dave is well-versed in his genre films, so we'll get to talk, well, undoubtedly, we're going to talk about everything from Universal to EC Comics to Gary Oldman's hair in the 90s. Join us. Hopefully it'll be a little more straightforward, because unlike Buckaroo Banzai, at least people know what vampires are.
Yes.
Now, if you don't know what vampires are, and you'd like to find out on social media, Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
Why, my fellow Blue Blazer regulars can contact me at 24Panels on Twitter, and what about you, Andrew?
You can find me at FilmStripper. You can also reach us through our website, up and running with more updates being added on a semi-regular basis. You can find find that website at a wonderful domain with the there we go, at filmstripspodcast.home.blog. You can find our entire show archive with more being updated as the episodes come out. You also get some opportunity to write a bit of long form feedback if you're so inclined. Let us know what works, what doesn't, and how we can make our second longest episode and have so little concrete to say about it. Otherwise, you can rate and review us on iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. Reviews there will always be read by myself and David. And 5-star reviews help move us up the charts. They help promote our show and bring new eyes and ears to our show. And honestly, your feedback is important to us, folks. We know that we're not exactly the most, we're kind of like the W.D. Richter of podcasting. We're sort of figuring it out as it goes along. But if you leave us your feedback, we can adjust accordingly and keep on bringing you the kind of show that you want to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely. So until next time, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, but I have to keep it to the ones that won't get bleeped out.
Yes.
Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Particularly if it fills out the Declaration of War short form. Bye.
Oh, yeah! That thing.